Are there any questions so far? I'd like to give a talk called Brewing Freedom. And I'm happy that the weather is also cooperating, brewing a storm. And here, this is Keturah, in case you didn't make it to the yoga this morning, without whom the retreat would not be possible, because she's with my son, morning to evening. And this talk is partly in honor of some women who lived in India some centuries ago and practiced tantric spirituality, and often had work that was considered dirty, or that the religious term would be unclean. Don't even want to say the word dirty, just call it unclean. Like serving alcohol, for example. Until not too long ago in India, until the British came along in India, alcohol would have been considered something that other people do, but not Indians. Now, more and more in India, there's the rush to copy our culture. But at that time, there was this kind of problematic looking down on people who did what was considered unclean. So looking down on the other people who did drink alcohol, who did serve it, who made it. And there were women who discovered, they found out that a spiritual path is possible. And they started to practice intensive meditation. But they continued with their work of serving alcohol or making alcohol. And they kind of inclined their work towards their spiritual path. And so as they would brew the alcohol, they would feel inside how they were also fermenting, let's say, the poisons that we've experienced today, for example, that we experience every day. Poisons of feeling small, or feeling better than, or feeling frustration or desperation or boredom or whatever. And fermenting whatever it is that comes up, the possibility of not just calling it unclean and other and trying to keep away from it, but kind of containing it and finding a way of making it not just drinkable, but making it into a kind of magical potion. And so they would invent songs as they would brew, which I'm not going to sing, but but we could feel what our own songs are about brewing the difficulties into something not just sort of edible or drinkable, but something that could be a way. So not just transforming what's difficult, but that in the transforming of what's difficult, it's a transformative path to another dimension, another way of living. So sometimes we've had moments that we've kind of fallen in to another dimension in life, usually in the most simple way. Feel free to be comfortable. Just suddenly a sound or some music or the way the light falls on the grass or whatever catches us by surprise, and the colors get more vivid and there's more space. So we have some sense already that there are other dimensions, let's say. And it's easy to think that we have to make ourselves better in order to live there. And it's easy to think that to make myself better, I have to get that stuff out. I have to get rid of that bad stuff. That anger or self-hatred or rage against the world or whatever. And then our spiritual path becomes a torture and also doesn't work. There's a lovely poem by a cartoonist from Melbourne, Australia named Michael Lunig. And the poem is called Let It Go. He says, let it go, let it out, let it all unravel. Let it free and it will be a path on which to travel. And I wish I had some of his little drawings that go with his cartoons usually. This is just a poem, which is unusual. He usually has, there might be a human being who's sort of a nothing special kind of person, like all of us, who's having a conversation with what might be the person's heart, or it might be some divinity, or we're not sure what it is, but the shape is a duck. So he's talking to a duck and having this spiritual conversation. So let it go, let it out. So that kind of conversation. Let it all unravel. Let it free, and it will be a path on which to travel. And one thing that I love about this little poem is, even though we might like to hear the poem as only addressing our difficulties that we're trying to hide from each other and from ourselves and pretend I don't have all of that rage or fear or whatever, but he doesn't say, let go of your difficulties. He just says, let it go, let it out, let it all unravel. So it's not only our difficulties, but everything. Let it all unravel, let it free, and it will be a path on which to travel. So sometimes it's easier to think about the difficulties where I felt ashamed of something that I thought was wrong with me. I was brewing alcohol and that was supposed to be wrong. There was something poisonous that needed special attention to make it edible, and I didn't know how to do that. And it kept coming out as more poisonous. We can imagine the relief of letting it go, and we can imagine, well, not just letting it go, letting it out, that could be freeing. Not just letting it go kind of into the trash can, hoping no one notices, but letting it out, not hiding anymore. And this is one quality that in the Buddha's teachings, they talk about the first, what can we call it? It's usually called the stage of enlightenment, but that is a horrible phrase. The first way of recognizing our way home, and it's called a stream enterer, so home as the stream. So we have our feet in the stream, and it feels good, and it's cool. And there can be a kind of recognition that there's hardly a way back because it's so good. We could just step out of the stream, and sometimes we might. But it's so good to have our feet in the stream that we'll probably stay with it even if it looks crazy or gets messy or stays messy. And one of the qualities of the stream enter, so one of the qualities that happens as we start to feel that there is a way home, there is a way to be ourselves on planet Earth that's not destructive and that's not kind of a torture to ourselves and to others. That's not an escape from what's painful, but it's present with everything, but it's also unshakable in another really beautiful way, not a defended way, but an awake way. And so the quality is no longer hiding our bad qualities. So there, you might have experienced a moment or a day like that, whether either by desperation or giving up, or by feeling joyful, there was less concern to hide your bad qualities. It was okay that you're messy, you're okay that you're not a good driver or whatever. So we can feel the goodness of letting it go. It might have happened sometimes today that there was a ton of thinking, and then there was a moment of, oh, maybe it's not all that important, or even if it is tomorrow, and just an out-breath or the breeze or something, or the taste of the food. So we can feel experientially the goodness of let it go, and we can also kind of echo with our own experience of let it out, that not defending or hiding or pretending. And the marvelous thing is letting it go, letting it out, let it all unravel. It does unravel. Today, it might seem like it's rather getting more knotted up and speeding up, and sometimes the first day is like that. But it might also already feel like there's more space in certain areas that you never thought there could be. Or things that you thought always had to stick together actually don't match. And they kind of come undone. Let it free. So letting the qualities in us that are wonderful that we can't even guess at, that our friends could maybe get a whiff of, but we can't really guess at. Letting that free. And even letting the qualities that are, the word flabbergasting comes to mind, that keep stubbornly resisting all of our efforts at self-improvement. Letting it unravel, letting it free, that a kind of radical trust that anything in your experience, anything in our experience, however stubborn or subtle, has some kind of live connection in it that could be called intelligence. And letting it unravel, letting it free. is what we practice. Feeling the difference between control and clarity. Clarity that's a spaciousness that leaves room to feel more and more subtly. So let it free. When we sort of open the door of a cage and an animal has been living in that cage for a while, depending on how long the animal's been living in that cage, it'll take some time for the letting it free to happen, for the realization that outside the cage is also good. Inside the cage is not the only option. Our training goes so much against this, but it's not so far away to feel for a radical trust in life, inside every experience. There was a yoga teacher, Vanda Scaravelli, in Italy, who some of her students are kind of active and famous yoga teachers now. And one of the things that she said about yoga, which we can hear meditation or spiritual path or just life. So, but for yoga, she's speaking about yoga, physical yoga, I can say. Yoga should not be a training for body control. On the contrary, it must bring freedom to the body, all the freedom it needs. So we could already just pause here in what she's saying, to apply it better to meditation. So with meditation, we're working mostly with the mind. You've already noticed the connections, that it's impossible to separate how the body is and how the mind is. If you want to come and be comfortable, Greg, please feel free. Whatever is more comfortable for you. But it's so easy, even if the instructions have never been about controlling your mind. It's easy to get the impression that you're doing badly if your mind is not being controlled, if you are not controlling your mind. So we could say meditation does not need to be a training for mind control. On the contrary, it is about bringing freedom to the mind. How does that sound? Bringing freedom to the mind is such a respect that we lack for our own mind. Because it's so painful the way the mind is trained, it's so painful the kind of thinking that we're habituated to. It's so easy to get into this antagonism with the mind. But I'm talking about mind, mostly our experience of mind is the thinking, backed up by emotion or directed by emotion. So she doesn't say it's not a training at all, but she says not a training for body control. So we're saying not a training for mind control. On the contrary, she says it must bring freedom. So I'm saying it can be a training to bring freedom to the mind. And included in there is freedom to the relationship between the mind and the body. Freedom for there to be a friendship between the mind and the body and the mind. Also, the world, the ground, the body and the mind. And I love how she says, on the contrary, it must bring freedom to the body, all the freedom it needs. And it's not clear what it she's talking about. All the freedom the body needs, we guess. So all the freedom that the mind needs. How much freedom does the mind need, and what is that? And then she talks about bringing about what she calls order in the body. And this could be a word that we wouldn't use now. She used it a generation ago. So feeling what she might mean. To me, what I hear is, do you have any view of trees out there? Yes, okay. I have view of some leaves out there. So the kind of order that's in nature, where there's a kind of rhythm. So on the tree, there are so many different colors and shapes, variations on a theme, variations on a shape and a color. And so it's not what we think of as order would be. It should be the in rows, exactly the same shape, exactly the same color. Maybe also it should turn to the sun exactly in, you know. So we can have the chance here where we have so much space that is devoted to the unbuilt, to get an experiential sense of what order could be from the natural world. We can't say that this is a natural world untouched by human hands, but also maybe we don't need that to get the sense of order that can be in harmony with chaos. So it can be in harmony with the unexpected, the unknown. And then what she's saying is to bring about the order in the body that is necessary for it to function properly. And again, these are kind of words from a generation ago. To function properly gives a certain tone to me. If you remember, she's talking about all the freedom that it needs. As a kind of, we can call it alignment, with a deep nature. So uncovering a deep nature of the mind that brings about a kind of deeply natural order that's not fixed and it's not controlled and it's also not predictable. And I think it's even surprising to hear the possibility that there could be a way that the mind could function properly. I think there could be the wish to just like root out the mind, just cut it out. And some kind of ideal of living from somewhere else without that crap. And so we could hear the tantric women from centuries ago in India. Where I live in Spain, we have a dry compost toilet, and it's one of my favorite things in the world to take the composted caca and sawdust and feed it to the trees. So we could feel that kind of fermenting of crap, and call it crap, it is. It's what is no longer needed that has naturally been shed and needs some care so that it isn't poisonous. And that's what we're missing. It's just that piece of how to ferment it so that it's food. And for whom does it, what does it feed? And then Vanda Scaravelli jumps to say that basically as the body has the training that gives it the freedom that it needs, all the freedom that it needs. So that a deeply natural, let's say, rhythm starts to come through. You can call it order or alignment or sense of calling. Then she says, freedom is order in both body and mind. So she's coming from physical yoga as a main spiritual practice that's not only done through outside in, not only done through copy the posture and let that sink in and seep in. It's also done the other way around and then call and response between outer and inner. And if we can get the beauty of the rhythm, the inescapability of body and mind, and that they could express alignment with something deeper. And then she talks about clear communication to the body. We could also talk about clear communication to the mind. And that these clear directions are not dictated by ambitions, duties, or reactions. So that we could find a way, where is the voice that has the power that will be listened to by body and mind that is not coming from ambition, even the subtle ambition of I want to be a better person, I want to be a good meditator, that's also ambition. What is a voice that doesn't know what ambition is, or it knows what it is and has no part in that? That has no part in duties. A power with a voice in a human being that can give clear directions, so it can be a leader, it can be a guide, that has no part in duties. It is not dutiful. And is not dictated by reaction. So, those three things pretty much cover mostly how we're living. Ambition, duty, reaction. Usually a pairing of those, at least. But clear directions that are given by what she calls a lucid, she calls a precise and lucid perception of what we feel. So we're starting to get the taste of let it go, let it out, let it all unravel, let it free, and it will be. So we don't even have to let it be, let it free. It's not in your hands. You didn't create that anger or fear or whatever. It's not in your hands, but you can feel. Let it free, and it will be a path on which to travel. So it gives us something to go with, something that we can feel. We can start with even raw, strong emotion, if that's what's happening. We don't need to go and look for it. It will come. So if we can feel humbled by how our training so far has been to be dictated to by ambition, we should be the best. We should do it perfectly. And we should definitely sort of always try to be comparing and competing. So in some contexts, openly, and in this kind of context, it should be more secretly, but it should still. We're trained to be picking up signals to know what's better and try to get to do that. Or the other way is to assume that I'll never get there and to put myself in the failure category as a way to avoid feeling. So our training is avoid feeling through competition, whether you put yourself at the top or the bottom. Whether you identify as success or failure, accepted or rejected. So this is our training. It's not what we're stuck with. But let's just hear it again and be humbled by how much of our lives is involved in duty. And again, whether following through what I think my duty is or reacting against what I thought my duty was and saying no. But just tied to our understanding of our duty. And if we just go in here a little bit deeper, it could be then that we feel hopeless, and that could be a way in. Because if all I know is to either do the right thing or to say I'm tired of doing the right thing, leave me alone. And if even when I react against duty, I'm still tied to it, so then what's the point? I tried my best. I worked so hard at it. I did what everyone wanted. I did the right thing. I was right. So it could be through giving up and being hopeless that can be positive. Can be positive to let hopelessness come. And the reason why is that there is a whole other world in a whole other way that just needs to be uncovered a little bit. Harriet Tubman, I think it is, used to say with the Underground Railroad, helping people get to freedom, to the free states, that just when you think you can't go on, just go a little bit more. And I used to hear that as kind of keep the pressure on, stick to your duty even a little bit longer. And what I hear it now is having gone way beyond, I think it's partly through living as a mother, I can get some little bit of a flavor of what that must have been like to be doing such an amazing, to do the Underground Railroad. Do you know what that is? Bringing people of color out of the southern states. That when you've already, you tried duty and that didn't work and wasn't enough also, and there's still a need that needs a response. And so out of love you do it, and then still it's not enough. And your body is tired and your brain is short-circuiting. And then there's a sense of it's not all about you. Like, you cannot do it alone. And so that kind of giving up, that kind of hopelessness, it would be impossible for you as an individual to go on, to have the answer, to have the energy, etc. So that kind of hopelessness, giving up. And then there's this wider sense, and that's when the creativity can come through. That's when there's been an uncovering of this deeper, let's say, natural alignment. A deeper love of what we love, a deeper love of being in alignment with something that's not about individual. It's not against the individual either. of course, let me just make that clear. It fully includes the individual. So, having helped to get out of the slavery to ambition and duties, and then the last one is reaction. So, like, what isn't a reaction? We just feel today. What hasn't been a reaction? It's hard to feel, and so I want to give you a moment to reassess. So it's easier to feel the reactions. It's easier to feel back through the day and be humbled by how many thoughts were reactions to stimuli. Whether it was a thought that you were thinking, a memory that came, and then a reaction to the memory, or a word that you heard, or a look on someone's face, or whatever it was, a sound or a taste or whatever. Even if it's hard to recognize how much reaction is going on, and how less room there is for just freshness. It's hard to accept that, and it's hard to just be humbled by it and steady. It's just humbling, that's all. It doesn't put you off the human map or out of the human circle or out of the natural world or something. It's simply humbling, and we're in it together, so here we are. And it's hard to feel the moments that are not about reaction, because there is less of a sense of I. So it's recorded in a different way in the system. And it has a lightness to it that's harder to remember. So don't be fooled by when you're in a cranky mood and you think, oh, it's all reaction, I never get out of here, and ugh. That's also not true. Let's say it could be that there's 90% or more of what's happening is reaction. But the importance of that other 1% or 10% or whatever it is. And how subtle it is, and how slippery, how much more ungraspable than the nice, hard reactions. So Wanda Scaravelli is talking about what she experienced as the guidance that we can receive through a precise and lucid perception of what we feel. And so what that means today is just remembering that we feel. And so there might be like a steam train of thoughts going on, and then just remembering, I can feel. And then, oh, there might be a memory that's coming, and it might be important to feel that. Instead of assuming that, oh, a memory is a thought and a thought is wrong, let me come back to the breath. It might be important to feel the breath with that. Let it come. Might be. If it starts to be overwhelming, it could be important to break through that and see green or feel the feet or whatever. It might be important to break the momentum and come into contact with the living quality through something direct. But it might be that there is living quality that you can feel, and it's important to just let the feeling capacity be precise and lucid. And then there's a process that we could call the brewing, that we could call the fermentation, that we could call the transmutation of poison to drink. And it's sort of a weeding out of in the feeling, which includes emotion, but is not only that. It includes the body aspect of feeling, but it's not only that. So it's not only body and it's not only emotion, it's also some kind of subtle feeling that's also available. And our chances to feel that grow with practice. And so it starts to be a weeding out of what is reaction, what is ambition, what is duty, getting unraveled from a subtle feeling that has a kind of innocence and kind of goes against the stream. So it starts to show its leadership. It starts to show its guiding quality. And that takes time and practice. It takes allowing the subtle to have some space to be felt. And it takes courage just to feel it, and it will go against your expectation of how you should be and what everyone else should be. And it takes a lot of time and practice and kindness to start to follow that lead. So there's a lovely poem by Wendell Berry in this book called Sabbaths. It's the first one. And this is a poem I can't believe that I never had heard until last week. So I'll probably read the whole thing, and we might continue with some of the poem tomorrow, but it's basically talking about this weeding out and recovering the innocence of the possibility of perceiving precisely and subtly the feelings that have intelligence, that have the possibility of leading our lives, of giving the body and mind clear directions that bring out the unexpected, seemingly impossible alignment with deep mystery. So it's simply, it's in a book called Sabbath, and it simply has a one. So it's like Sabbath one. I go among trees and sit still. All my stirring becomes quiet around me like circles on water. My tasks lie in their places where I left them, asleep like cattle. Then what is afraid of me comes and lives a while in my sight. What it fears in me leaves me, and the fear of me leaves it. It sings, and I hear its song. Then what I am afraid of comes. I live for a while in its sight. What I fear in it leaves it, and the fear of it leaves me. It sings, and I hear its song. After days of labor, mute in my consternations, I hear my song at last, and I sing it. As we sing, the day turns, the trees move. I think we've come to think that coming to stillness is no longer natural or possible. And so just to leave room for that possibility, we can't make it happen. But sometimes the stirring does get quiet by chance. And it so happens that our busyness falls asleep. And I love the image of my tasks lie in their places where I left them, like cattle. So cattle being domesticated animals who are more or less obedient and strong and used and they're just sleeping where I left them. We just let that be for now. And then he says, what is afraid of me comes. And this is a beautiful part of meditation that we can easily misinterpret. So as the quietness starts to come, what is afraid of us comes. And if we could hear and feel that, as my image for it is being like in a forest clearing quietly, and a deer comes and drinks. Our stirring isn't keeping it away, and so it comes. And sometimes what comes is grace, and sometimes what comes is pain. It had been so afraid of us, it couldn't come. But the stirring, settling, leaves space for things to come, things that were afraid of us. Things that were afraid of the way our lives were directed by ambition, duty, and reaction. And those things come and live for a while in our sight. So they bear our gaze, they allow us to see. That seeing is a kind of, has a mutuality. That's not a small event. I find it's not common, it's not easy, it's a rare event when something lets us see it, or someone lets us see it. And just by that innocence of seeing, so staying true to a subtle perception, a precise and lucid perception of our feeling, which is inbuilt, it's not something you have to create. The practice is just to leave room for it and to kind of trust that. You don't have to make it up. And not staying true to the dictatorship of ambition, so competitiveness, comparing, duty, and reaction. That may be going on, but you're just letting that ripple out into the water and not come into the seeing. And it allows, it's so gentle and spacious and non-doing that it allows like a further happening to happen. And that further happening is that what was in me that intimidated that leaves me. What is afraid of me comes and lives a while in my sight. What it fears in me leaves me. And the fear of me leaves it. So it starts to be friendship in our body, in our mind, in our psyche, in our deep spiritual being, which already starts to go beyond our skin. So if we think of Wanda Scaravelli and the yoga, sometimes she might tell people to take a certain shape and feel and let that resonate inwardly, until a certain connection happens, a certain amount of experience of inner alignment happens, so that then you take the pose inwardly and let that shape the body. And then there starts to be a conversation. And so there's a sense of the goodness of there being an outward, from outward to inward, and from inward to outward. And it also starts to, even if there's a goodness of having those two directions as distinct movements, distinct ways, distinct modes, there's also a non-duality. There's a sense of the non-duality as well. And that sort of allowing what's in me that has been afraid to come and to be seen and for a release to come about is part of a respectful life. So it's respecting what had been hidden, what had been afraid, so that it doesn't be poisonous. And maybe tomorrow we'll talk a little bit more about the rest of the poem. But just to kind of have the chance of feeling, what am I afraid of? So this third stanza of, then what I am afraid of comes. I live for a while in its sight. What does the poet, what is he talking about? Is there any question or comment?
When you talk about thinking in the mind and bringing order or control to that, which that's a difficult topic. Thinking being a spiritual activity and a will-driven activity as well, can you speak about the, there's a saying that I've heard by a man named Dennis Klochak. He says, when you think into your will, that is love. When you will into your thinking, that is freedom. Because from my understanding of that is that when we bring will force into our thinking, we find freedom because we can direct it, or we can use it as a rudder for the emotional waves that come and go. And then when we think into the will, that's love. That's that.
Okay. So that's a big one to try to go into now, but I think that in the teaching you're speaking of, the sense of will must be bigger from how I usually use the word. So for me, the sense of will and thinking, neither of them are inherently spiritual in my experience. Neither of them. And mostly they are not used that way. And so sometimes, just as with the yoga posture, sometimes there needs to come some kind of outward direction, take this shape. So today we had, what about feeling the contact with the ground, letting the body spread out, and feeling the out-breath? Or what about letting the sounds come in and feeling how receptive you already are to the sounds? And okay, there's going to be a lot of thinking. That's not a big deal. It's also not all that's happening. Oh, okay. The relief of letting go of that train of thought and something alive and subtle. So that's using the will to cut through the habit energy involved in thinking to reveal something else that's happening. And so we could say to start to unveil another will, but I wouldn't use that word. But then through technique, we start to have enough, we happen upon enough experience of what I'm calling alignment, that then we can tune to alignment from inside and see how it acts. What does it do today? And then we might need a good long period that it's okay to be allergic to technique, that you can't stand to hear someone tell you follow your breath or whatever, that you really need to practice from the inside out for a while. And then again, there can start to be some interest. Oh, I've never tried that. Let's see, experimentation. When the confidence is what I would call it, rather than will again, has grown, which is one of the main lacks that we have, is confidence in recognizing the quality of what I'm calling alignment. From alignment, the thought that may come is first of all few and far between, and second of all, it carries that quality of the deep, what Vanda Scaravelli called order. We talked about what we mean by that. (Laughs) And it's also lovely to feel how the possibility of finding a way that the mind experiences freedom that's not about, so as Scaravelli says, it's not about license, it's not about addiction. It's not about getting to do what it thinks it wants, but something so much better than that, actually. And it takes a while to be freed from the addictions, especially the addictions to approval, basically, to fall in love with something better than that, that I would call love. So I'm trying to kind of feel my way into the teaching that you mentioned, but it's still, we could maybe go more tomorrow. Thank you. So we have time for walking, and then there'll be the last half hour meditation before supper. There's about just 20, a little bit more than 20 minutes for walking now. Thank you.